Last week, we talked about emotions. And one of the things we talked about, of course, is that, you know, if we don't take emotions so personally, if we just let them be, they're really not such a problem. And of course, the problem isn't emotions. The problem, if you will, is holding on to them. Okay? This is when we suffer. This is when we suffer, when we hold on to these mental qualities. They're natural parts of our human experience. They will arise. The question is not whether or not they will arise. The question is, what do we do when these emotions, when these mental qualities arise? Can we let go of the mental qualities that we discern aren't useful, aren't serving us? Unskillful mental qualities? Can we just let them be? Or are we going to hold on to them? So it's really up to us. It's about what we do. If we hold on, if we cling, we'll suffer. This is what the teaching suggests. We have to see this for ourselves. What happens when I hold on? Now, these unskillful mental qualities all come under the heading of, they come under three headings, you know, and there's of course lots of subsets under these three headings: aversion, desire, and delusion. Generally speaking, for our purposes, you know, if we are concerned with aversion and its various forms, and desire with its various forms, and begin to explore those particular emotions, to see them for what they are, to understand that they don't have to be held on to, and if we can learn to develop a skillful relationship to them, we'll come to know greater happiness in our lives, to the degree, of course, to which we develop a skillful relationship to them. So, you know, aversion and desire, these are the emotional qualities, you know, and every, all the different permutations that we have to watch out for. It's really quite simple, and of course this was a lot of the Buddha's genius, being able to simplify things, being able to understand, you know, because when you really understand, when you don't understand, things are complicated. You know, the Buddha understood, so things were actually quite simple. So, you know, very simply, we can think of aversion as I don't want. I don't want, I don't like. And we can think of desire as I want. I like and I want. So, you know, these are the mental qualities, the mental states, the emotional states that arise and that we hold on to. I don't want and I want. And, of course, out of that clinging comes action. So there's the action of thinking, boy, I really want that, I've got to have that, you know, da-da-da, or, you know, I really don't want that, this is terrible, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, whatever. So there's thinking and there's action, you know. So we take action, by and large, in our lives because, as we talked about last week, most of our lives are driven by these mental qualities of aversion and desire. So a good deal of the action that we take in life is driven by aversion and desire. I don't want that. I want that. This is the action that we take. Because it's all about action, right? You know, it's all about action. It's all about what we do in this life. That's what really ultimately determines our happiness. There's the microscopic action of holding on to the mental quality, and then there's the physical, verbal, and mental action that follows on the more macrocosmic scale. One of the things that's really, of course, very interesting about these actions, which, you know, are the primary actions that we take, I don't want and I want, is that they're very self-centered. They're very self-centered. It's always about I. You know, I always say this, watch your thinking over the course of the day. You know, it's about I. I like that, I don't like that, I want that, I don't want that. You know, so our action tends to be very self-centered. I want, I don't want. So what we're learning to do, and again, it's very, in a way, it's a very simple practice to really begin to understand, if we want to hold on, cling to these mental qualities of aversion and desire, to begin to understand whether or not we want to take this action that's driven by aversion and desire, I want and I don't want, as we develop disenchantment with those actions and that holding on less to aversion and desire, and instead of holding on to aversion and desire, cultivating skillful mental qualities. You know, and again, very simple. Love and compassion. So really simple. Aversion, desire, love and compassion. So, you know, this, we could say, is our, you know, is our objective, that little by slowly, you know, less holding on to aversion and desire, less action driven by I want and I don't want, and more cultivation of love and compassion and more action, because again, it's all about action, more action that's motivated by love, more action that's motivated by compassion. So, you know, less self-centeredness, less self-centered action, you know, less action that's about getting, I want, you know, or being. You know, sometimes we talk about getting and being. You know, I want this, you know, I want to become this, you know, in terms of status and praise. So less action that's about getting and being. And I'm talking about the action that we take towards ourselves, you know, because there's lots of action that we can take vis-a-vis ourselves that isn't about getting something or being somebody. I mean, that can go both ways, you know. It's like I can teach this class and it can be about getting and being. You know, I want to get something. I want to get a lot of Donna or whatever. And it could be about being, you know, or I want to get career or whatever, and it could be about being, wanting to be recognized or whatever, or it could be about action that's motivated by love and compassion. So, you know, this is what we strive for, this is what I strive for. So it's about less action vis-a-vis ourselves that's self-centered, in other words, about aversion and desire. You know, this is how self gets created, by aversion and desire. I want, I don't want. So it's about less action that's motivated by aversion, desire, less action that's about getting and being in terms of ourselves, you know, so more action that's not about getting and being with regard to ourselves, and also more action that's not only about ourselves, you know, not only about ourselves. Now, self-love is really important. We talk a lot about self-love. Self-love is extremely important. You know? And we need to learn to take action. We need to learn to cultivate self-love, which a lot of the way that we cultivate self-love, of course, is by letting go of self-hatred. But, you know, we need to cultivate self-love. And, you know, it's one of the things that we're doing with metta practice. But we can cultivate self-love with a lot of different kinds of actions that we take. I mean, we cultivate self-love. Self-love is essential so that we can take action that's motivated by our wish to be happy, as opposed to action that's motivated by our wish to get something or be something. So it's action motivated by our wish to be happy of heart, to have a heart that's free of desire and aversion, a heart that's free of clinging. I mean, this is a good definition, subtraction-wise, of what, you know, true happiness is. It's the happiness that happens when, it's the happiness that we know that we take action that isn't motivated by clinging, that isn't motivated by desire and aversion. So, you know, self-love is essential for us to take action that's motivated by love and compassion. So, for instance, you need to have self-love in order to follow this path. You know, if you don't have self-love, you're not going to follow the path. You know, and I see this a lot because, it's interesting from my own perspective, but also as a teacher, a lot of times I see people, taking different kinds of unskillful action, sort of wanting to let go of certain patterns of holding on, certain ways of manifesting and acting out on desire and aversion, but there isn't quite enough self-love to really want to do that. And as long as there's self-hatred, you're going to keep acting out on self-centered action that isn't good for you. Because if you have self-hatred, you're going to do things that aren't good for you. That's why judging unskillful action only takes you further away from the path, because all you're doing is reinforcing self-hatred, which is going to make you continue to take the actions that you were judging yourself for in the first place. So, we need self-love to follow this path. I mean, you're not going to get to the path, this path of ending suffering or finding true happiness, unless there's self-love. And in order to, really the degree to which we have self-love is directly relatable. There's a one-to-one correspondence between the degree to which we have self-love and self-compassion and the degree to which we're going to practice. So the more we practice, the more we develop self-love and compassion, and then the more we practice. And then we practice more, we develop more self-love and more compassion, and we practice more. I think a lot of us know the story of the acrobats. It's one of the stories that the Buddha, that we talk about a lot, that the Buddha comes from, the teachings of the Buddha, where there were two acrobats, and, I always say, think of the old Ed Sullivan show, but that a lot of people might not relate to that. But think of one acrobat as like on the ground and has a, and is like holding a pole, and the other acrobat is on, you can think of the Olympics, sort of. And the other acrobat is on the top of the pole, balancing, standing on top of the pole or sitting on top of the pole. And the acrobat on the ground holding the pole says to the acrobat on top, I'll look after you and you look after me and we'll be fine. And the one on the top says, no, you look after yourself, and I'll look after myself and then we'll be fine. So it's a little bit of a conundrum. So they go to the Buddha. And he said, who's right? And the Buddha says, well, the acrobat on the top of the pole is right. You've got to watch out for yourself first before you can watch out for somebody else. If that acrobat standing on the ground isn't watching out for himself, no matter, he's going to fall or he's going to trip or he's going to lose his balance, the other acrobat is going to fall. So the Buddha says, first you have to watch out for yourself. You have to watch out for yourself. You have to develop self-love. You have to take action that's motivated by self-love, like the action of practicing the Dharma and all the other things that we do in order to take care of ourselves and find greater happiness in our lives. So, the Buddha says, watch after yourself, then you'll be able to watch after others. So we have to watch out for ourselves. But of course, we also have to watch out for others. He doesn't say, just watch out for yourself and leave it at that. He says, watch out for yourself, and then you'll be able to watch out for others. So this is an important part of our path. This is just as important as watching out for ourselves as watching out for others. It's just that we need to watch out for ourselves first before we can watch out for others. We always talk about this. It makes a lot of sense. How can I teach the Dharma if I don't take care of myself, if I don't go on retreats, if I don't start to let go of some of my aversion and some of my desire, if I don't learn to develop more love and compassion, how am I going to teach? It's like, who wants somebody teaching them who's, riddled with desire and aversion and who's unskillful? None of us want that. So, and that's not going to be helpful. So we have to watch out for ourselves, but we have to watch out for others. We have to watch out for others. The Buddha was looking for true happiness. What was true happiness? He had this life of getting and being. He had a lot of stuff. He had a lot of possessions. He had a lot of status. He was a prince. He questioned that. He wanted to see if there was something greater than that. And, what he found was that there was a true happiness, a happiness inside, happiness that came from letting go of desire and aversion, letting go of getting and being. This happiness, this profound happiness of that was inside, that was really, came out of this place of not holding on. And what he also understood in terms of true happiness was that, you know, what he also understood in terms of what an awakened life was, is that it had to include, you know, there was this quality that he was able to develop of non-clinging, you know, the happiness of the heart, the happiness of love and compassion. And what he came to understand was that love and compassion had to be expressed if his life was going to be enlightened, awakened. You know, there had to be awakened, enlightened action. In other words, he took care of himself by becoming awakened. Now he had to take care of others. So that's what he did. He spent the next 45 years taking care of others, took care of himself and took care of others. Yeah, and of course, during that 45 years, every once in a while, he'd go off and meditate on his own to get his chops, to make sure he kept his chops tight. But, you know, he spent, you know, once he attained freedom of heart, once he attained the quality of open-heartedness and was able to express love and compassion, he had to express that. And that's what he did, because that's what an awakened life is. I mean, that's what his path tells us. That's what his story tells us. I mean, he considered it, you know. Well, you know, I'm really blissed out, you know. I'm really blissed out. I'm really in this state, you know. And he hung out for a week, you know. It's like retreat, right? You know, it's like he hung out for a week, just completely blissed out. And he said, I can't do this forever. You know, this is great, but I got to go do something. Because, you know, my work isn't done yet in terms of manifesting true happiness and what a life of true happiness is. I have to go out and help others. This is what the path is. This is the Buddha's story. You know, so the path is not about, you know, just doing for ourselves, watching out for others and experiencing, you know, some kind of inner bliss or inner happiness. It also includes watching out for others, helping others. This is what an awakened life is. So as Dharma students, you know, seeking true happiness, seeking an awakened life, a life of greater happiness, you know, we really need to consider that, you know, this kind of life includes love and compassion for others, practicing generosity and helping others, watching out for others. This is integral to the path. It's not like, well, maybe I won't choose that option. You know? I mean, if you're in it, this is integral to the path, watching out for others. So, you know, one of the, you know, important questions that we have to ask, you know, we always have to ask about our resolve. You know, why am I doing this? You know, we start off with some intentions for doing this. Oftentimes it's because we're suffering, you know. But those intentions and those resolves have to evolve over time. You know, if you're newer, you're probably, you know, mostly focused on taking care of yourself and watching after yourself. But certainly if you've been around here for a while, and truthfully, everybody, even if you are new, I mean, it's all about degree and proportion and priority, you know, but gradually more and more, the more you begin to take care of yourself, the more you have to start, you know, learning to take care of others and watching out for others. I mean, that's the path. You know, the degree to which you are able to take care of yourself and watch out for others will determine how much you can begin to take yourself will determine how much you can begin to take care of others. So, you know, as you grow as a student, as you move along the path as a Dharma student, if you're really in it, you know, if you're really committed to this path, you have to ask, you know, it's like, you know, what's my intention? What's my resolve? You know, resolve is that broad intention. You know, is it a self-centered resolve? Is it a self-centered resolve? Is it all about me? You know, is it all about me? You know, it's like, what's my resolve as a Dharma student? What's my resolve, you know, I mean, is my practice just about me? Is it just about meditating and going on retreats and, you know, and experiencing moments of bliss or even less suffering? Even less suffering? You know, sometimes many people, I mean, that's sort of like, I mean, that's an extraordinarily noble intention, is to end suffering. You know, but there's more to the path than ending suffering. I mean, that would be kind of a bummer, right? You know, if it was only about ending suffering. You know, it's about true happiness, and we manifest true happiness by helping, you know, helping ourselves, but also helping others. You know, so what's our path about? Is it just about, you know, is my intention self-centered, or does it also include helping others? Does it also include watching out for others? you know, so then we have to kind of look at, you know, I mean, it's you know, well, what's my role in terms of a meditation student, you know, as a meta member of this group? Does it include just coming here and getting all the great stuff they offer, you know, and you know, the hearing the teachings, you know, really cheap, $5 on a Sunday night, you know? Yeah, it's like, oh, you know? Or does it include helping out as a member of the group? You know, and of course that, you know, and when we start to look at our resolve, I mean, our practice, you know, we're just learning in practice. We're just learning in practice and as a member of the group how to live. I mean, it's all just a microcosm of life. It is life. So, you know, what's my resolve as a Dharma student in terms of my life? Is it all about getting? You know, is it all about getting stuff? You know, and I think some of us, you know, come to the practice so we can have less suffering and less agitation in our lives and less stress, so that therefore then we can get stuff that we want. You know, once I get my, you know, I'm less stressed out, then maybe I'll get the career that I want and the relationship and all that stuff. Well, maybe that'll happen, but is, you know, and that's all fine, but is that what it's all about for us? Is our resolve in life self-centered? Is it all about getting and being? I mean, you know, we need some stuff. We need some stuff. You know? I mean, we need food, we need clothing, we need shelter, we need medicine. You know, we need some stuff. The question is, how much do you need? I mean, the question is really like, what kind of life do you want to live? Do you want to live a life in which your goal is to get stuff and be somebody? What kind of life is that? What kind of life is that? You know, I mean, maybe we don't have the insight into that, but what kind of life is that? You know, what kind of life? I mean, I see people, you know? I mean, it's like, you know, we see people sort of out, you know, it's, you know, to some extent preaching to the choir, I guess, but, you know, it's like particularly when I go outside of the realm of, you know, Dharma, I mean, it's like it's such a limited existence. It's such a limited way of living, you know, where our life is all about getting and being. Is this how we want to spend our life? Making more money and getting more stuff. I mean, the Buddha would say that's ignorance, making life about that. I mean, you know, really, I mean, if you really take a step back and think about it, shouldn't life be more than just that? And like some possessions and some things, you know? And some notoriety and some acclaim? What kind of life is that? I mean, it should be more than that. I think there could be more of that. This is what the Buddha thought. I mean, this is what the Buddha thought. There's got to be more than this. This doesn't seem, you know, he said it's not fitting for me to live this kind of life. You know, we sell ourselves so short when we live this way. So is our life going to be this self-centered life, this life about getting and being, or is it going to be a life in which our action is driven by love for ourselves, but love also for others, compassion for others, in which we're watching out for others, in which we're helping others, in which we're trying to make this a better world. So, you know, it all starts with our resolve for ourselves, you know, that we practice for ourselves. It all starts with our resolve. You know, it's like, you know, the resolve that as a Dharma student that we make, or that we need to think about making, or that we need to think about evolving, is that we're practicing for ourselves, but we're also practicing for others. It's like, why are you practicing? Practicing for ourselves, and we're practicing for others. I mean, that would be the Buddha's resolve. That would be the resolve that, as a Dharma student, you know, we really need to consider. So, you know, if we can think about that our practice is for ourselves and for others, I mean, you know, we can start with the others in our lives, right? You know, we can start with our family, our partners, our children, our parents, you know, all of our family members. You know, it's like we're practicing for ourselves, but we're also practicing for them. You know, we talk about this a lot. People in this group talk about this a lot, you know, that their practice affects the people in their lives. You know, not because they go home and they tell them what I sermonized, you know, but because they become people who are able to relate to the other in their lives with greater love and compassion. So, people people talk about it all the time, about how, you know, their practices has affected their kids. And this is what it's all about. I mean, to me as a teacher, this is what it's all about. If somebody comes to me and says, you know, I've been practicing for a couple of years and I really see how it's making me a better parent and it's affecting my family. That's why I do this. That's why I do this, you know? I mean, that's it. I mean, it doesn't get, for me, any better than that. Then I've done my job, right? So, you know, we can begin with the people in our lives, our family, our friends. But of course, it's just not the people in our lives. It's others. It's all beings. It's the world at large. Because what we do here, even though we may scoff at the idea, has an effect on others. It has an effect on others. And this is really important to take to heart because, you know, we can be very skeptical about that. You know, that's not true. That seems like a rather immodest claim. Well, how does that happen? Well, it happens. It happens. You know, I mean, this is how these teachings have been passed on. I mean, this is how the teachings of love and compassion get passed on. You know, not by people preaching, but by people practicing and taking action that's motivated by love and compassion. So our resolve, I would submit to you, or your resolve, must include the intention to practice for others. And what I would submit to you is that you can't sustain practice otherwise. You can only sustain it up to a certain point if it's just about you. Because at a certain point, it's going to turn self-centered, and then it's going to turn impure if it's just about you. If your practice is just about you, it's going to become self-centered, and it's not going to be Dharma practice anymore. The Buddha didn't teach self-centered practice. We don't teach self-centered practice. If we can establish the resolve to practice for ourselves and for others, this is going to make a profound difference in our practice. I mean, this is something you can do every time you meditate. You know, all right, well, I'm going to follow the breath. I'm going to follow the steps, directed thought and evaluation out of love and compassion for myself and others. You don't have to do anything more than that in terms of what you're doing in terms of your practice, but, you know, you have to begin to point yourself in that direction. And one of the things I've seen and I continue to see is that, you know, if you establish a resolve to practice for others, it's going to strengthen your motivation to practice. It's going to give you a much stronger motivation to practice. You know, I mean, everybody complains about having a hard time getting motivated to practice. Oh, it's hard for me to get onto the cushion. It's hard for me to get to class. Well, start thinking about that you're doing this not just for yourself, but for others. Start thinking about that you're doing this with the people in your life. Start thinking about the fact that you're doing this for all beings. That's a motivation to practice. That'll strengthen your motivation to practice. You know, this intention, this resolve that includes the intention to practice for all beings brightens the mind. We always talk about how important it is for the mind to have a bright mind. The mind, we won't be able to develop concentration, we won't be able to develop the factors of jhana if the mind isn't bright. I've seen for myself so many times, like on retreats, when I've started to darken, the practice has gotten hard, you know, and I'll reflect on the fact that, you know, what I'm doing, you know, is important in the large scheme of things, that what I'm doing not just for myself, but I'm doing for others, that what I'm doing is going to have an effect on others in my life and others in general. That brings brightness to my life. What a blessing to be able to do something, to practice in a way in which I'm able to help others. So, you know, remember why you practice. You know, and the way you practice is going to be the way you live. We talk about that all the time. Practice is just an action. You're training yourself to take skillful action. You're training yourself to take awakened action. So remember why you practice when you practice. And practice in this way. You know, practice for yourself and practice for others. Practice for all beings. Live this way. Live your life that way. It'll make a difference. It'll lead you to having much greater happiness in your life and much greater meaning. So let's just sit for a moment.